Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley not. He will be back tomorrow, we trust. He had a pre-scheduled eye appointment today. Filling in for him, as is often the case here, Sherry Elliker from the East Coast. Welcome aboard, Sherry. Once again, it's always a delight to have you on.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so, you know, Boeing is a huge deal here in these parts, Sherry. I mean, I grew up here, basically, and it was like we were like a one-company town. We're no longer a one-company town, and Boeing has moved its headquarters to Chicago. I mean, this is quite a while ago, but for long-timers, old-timers like me, we still remember this. And we have a kind of fondness. It might just be sentimental reasons about Boeing. There still are a lot of Boeing workers here in the region, but, boy, it's been a couple of bad news years for Boeing. And so today we're actually delighted. We've got some bad news to share with you, but also some good news. And when we have something like that, a rarity around here, good news with Boeing, we like to bring in Chris Sullivan. That's right, the cherry pie guy, Chris Sullivan. Welcome aboard, Chris. You've actually got good news for Boeing fans, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. God, it seems like I haven't talked to you, Tom, in a million years. Yep. Every time I tune in, you're like taking off and I'm talking to Sherry. But low blow too soon. Good to hear from you too, Sherry. But yeah, definitely good news today. I mean, Boeing finally, you know, in the black on the financial ledger for the first time in a couple of years. And I mean, not a huge amount by their standards, but enough to kind of give a little shot in the arm. They beat Wall Street expectations, which was good. And so a little bit of positive news on the financial side, just to go over it quickly. Q2 earnings about, you know, $567 million, which, you know, for most companies is good, but Boeing used to make tons more. But last year in Q2, they lost $2.4 billion. So, yeah, put that in perspective, that's a pretty good turnaround. So that's positive. There's some positive things to take away from that on the financial ledger. There's still lots of issues to deal with when it comes to the production ledger. I mean, they only delivered 79 planes in the quarter. I mean, that's still more than last year. But year-to-date, only 156, and they're still having trouble getting those MAXes out to people. The Dreamliner, nobody wants right now because it's grounded itself anyway as they've halted production. Boeing has to go through some fuselage shimming issues and joining issues. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag, but at least from a financial standpoint, and hearing from CEO Calhoun today, saying that it looks like they've kind of stopped the job cutting for right now, which is a good thing. They were expecting to cut maybe another 10,000 globally, but it looks like that's kind of on hold, which is always great news considering how many of those jobs we seem to lose more of those, that percentage, considering how many of the workforce are actually here. So that's always very, very positive news.
So what do we attribute to the positives from this year as opposed to the negatives last year? I mean, you know, commercial air travel is picking up, but not in any significant way, is it? I'm assuming that whatever profits they're making is from the defense side of things and the space side of things as opposed to the commercial side of things. Is that correct?
BCA, the commercial side, is still dragging the company down. The defense and space once again leading the charge, and if it hadn't been for that side of the ledger, the last couple of years could have been even worse because with the tanker deal and whatnot and their other defense and space assets, they've been doing really well on that side. In fact, they've actually been adding employees on the defense side of the company while they've been cutting on the BCA side. So yeah, it's a certain turnaround from, you know, the Boeing you're used to, certainly, and the Boeing that I moved into here, you know, 15 or so years ago. Definitely it was the commercial side that was the bell cow, not so much anymore. So things have turned around, and air travel is back a little bit, but I mean, and I think the positive news can go to the fact that they're getting the MAXes back out. They're delivering airplanes. I mean, 50 of them this quarter, which is good, but I mean, they got a lot to get back up and running after the two tragedies.
Yeah, just to kind of catch people up. So the Maxes that had all those troubles and those two fatal crashes a couple of years ago, they are now, are they in active service? Are they flying successfully? Okay.
So, oh, yeah. Not in the huge numbers that they are still hundreds of them that they're trying to get back out of mothballs, and that's air quotes, that they had parked here in Moses Lake and any place they could find to park those planes during the pandemic when no one was flying. But that 737 is still that they're expecting that one to lead the charge, or at least the single aisle to lead the charge, because domestic flying is going to be coming back much faster, we believe, than international travel, which is where the 87 is and why the problems there. I mean, that, as I said, I mean, they've cut production on that down to next to nothing. They're figuring out some issues, and nobody wants that twin aisle plane right now because it's designed for routes that haven't really come back yet from the pandemic, those international routes.
And then one last question, Sherry, before I let you in here. I just wanted to, Airbus must be dealing with the same kind of economic pressures as Boeing is. Are they also, at wit's end? Are they doing better than Boeing, worse than Boeing, about the same?
They're doing much better than Boeing, at least when it comes to the order book. Their backlog, their new orders and things like that are way outpacing Boeing right now. And that's a lot has to do with the fact that for a while no one was buying, or they were giving back orders on the Max because of
Max,
all the concerns over it.
So the lingering effects of the Max
of that
disasters.
are still going because people are canceling orders, doing other things, Airbus is in a position right now, unlike we've seen in the last couple of decades, where it's kind of neck and neck, one year could be one or the other. Right now, they have a chance to really kind of take the lead, and it's basically based on the fallout from those two crashes.
Okay. Mm. Sherry?
Wow. Yeah, I remember this, and you may know this detail, Chris. I think it was an interview with United Airlines president, and it was back after the two crashes. And he said that he would alert every passenger or allow them, if they found out that it was going to be a 737 MAX, not to fly on that plane if they didn't want to. Did you ever hear anything about that? Did that ever materialize where someone was actually given the notice, this is a plane that it had some problems, you're going to be flying on it. If you don't want this plane, we'll get you another flight.
I believe that did happen in some way, shape, or form. And I know a lot of people who don't really pay attention to the planes that they are flying on beforehand were certainly going out and looking to see what, if it had Max next to it, they were okay mm-hmm. to switch their planes. Because let's face it, I mean, the mental side of this for a passenger, is quite palpable. I mean, until they figure that thing out, which they think they have. I believe that did happen. To what extent, I can't honestly say, because it's only been flying again since earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. So then, Chris, I'd like you also to address another fantastic Seattle Times article about Boeing's turnaround, how that turnaround could be threatened by the fact that they have experienced what Seattle Times lease headlines is as a talent exodus to companies like Amazon and SpaceX. Can you address that issue, that the drain on the employees at Boeing haven't just been cutbacks? There are people, engineers, being lured to what seem to be, and at least in the most recent terms, much more successful companies like Amazon and SpaceX, Elon Musk's venture.
Well, let's first, credit where credit is due, that is a Bloomberg article that was reprinted in the Seattle Times.
In the Seattle Times. Okay, fair enough.
So they did. I mean, this is one of those lengthy, like Sunday morning ones that you get into, and next thing you know, you're an hour in and four cups of coffee, and you're just like, whoa, there's just so much meat in this thing. For those people who still do that, so that's probably the two of you and one other person in the audience listening right now.
Well, summarize it for us, would you?
Yeah, so basically what it looks like is not only has Boeing been cutting positions and outsourcing positions for the last couple of decades to their detriment in some cases. A lot of these people are going not to competitors in aerospace, but to the other competitors in our region. And you mentioned Amazon One. It's so many people are going there because they're working on the future. They're still working in aviation because Prime Air is working on basically drones. and the aerospace that goes with delivering packages via drones or autonomous vehicles. So that appeals to the Boeing workers. And so they're, what is it, 1,100 former Boeing employees are now working at Amazon. Right now, a lot of them on that prime air side, certainly because you can make more money for Amazon and you don't have to move
their
families.
They're not working in the warehouses.
No, no. These people, but yeah, there is a huge worry about an intellectual property drain and, you know, and just a brain drain in terms of the engineers. Think about that. 3,200 engineers and technical workers have left Boeing in the last year and a half.
Wow.
Those are the people that are putting together the software, figuring out how the planes are supposed to fly, you know, how the engines, we're all of that stuff. And so, that's a significant amount. I know you're a big union guy, Tom. SPIA, everybody knows the aerospace, the engineers union. They had about 23,000 employees locally in 2010. That's down 38% now. Because they've gone elsewhere, or Boeing has cut them, or they have outsourced. And you have times where they're 30-plus year employees who retire, and then a week later, they get a call from SpaceX, like, hey, you want to come down to Kent? We're making a lot of money. Or Amazon. And so there's a big concern going forward if that pipeline of young go-getting engineers is there to make the next move, which is to, continuing the space race, perhaps working on drones, maybe a new airplane, their first ground up since the 787. And a lot of this will depend maybe on what happens on Friday, because the Starliner, Boeing's answer to SpaceX, which is basically the capsule. We call it the space taxi because it goes up and back to the space station. It failed its attempt in 2019 to lock up with the space station. So this is a big flight for them on Friday afternoon or midday for us. And if that's successful, maybe that'll re-energize things a little bit, put a little bit more confidence, a little more pep in the step for Boeing as they try to do that. But again, that's not a Puget Sound issue anymore. That's a Florida kind of thing. Here, and that's a Boeing space and defense side thing too. So, but another either way, go ahead.
I was going to say another wrinkle in that in-depth article, as you point out, was that it was a strategy on Boeing's part to increase their bottom line. So they ended up cutting because they anticipated things were going to get tighter and they're going to need to make sure their bottom line, came out looking better than not. But they think they might have cut too close to the bone, and other companies didn't do that. And so now that the world is ramping up faster than they expected, that strategy is kind of backfired. They thought they were being lean and mean, and now they realize that they perhaps overcut. They've lost a lot of talk about brain drain. They lost a lot of that brain drain under their own policy decisions.
R&D spending down 23% and things like that. And let's face it, it was the idea of those charged the company the last decade or so to not go for the shoot the moon, not to go for the home run.
Right.
We need to pull things back in after we saw what happened without all the outsourcing. That's why we ended up with a re-engine 737, which has become its own particular issue, as opposed to a brand new single aisle plane from ground up. They were like, hey, we don't need to make a whole new thing, spend a lot of money on it. Let's just re-engine this thing. And the bottom line, it comes down to this. Who do you want to keep happy? Your company or your shareholders? Why do you think Boeing's been doing so great in the stock market over the last 5 years? Because they've been doing things with their eye on the boardroom and maybe not necessarily on the health of the company to a lot
demand.
Of people. And I hear that from a lot of my engineer friends. I hear that from a lot of my mechanic friends who work on building these planes and whatnot. And it was a very strategic decision made to kind of focus that way. Let's make sure that we are profitable. A couple of years ago, they were making over $100 billion a year.
Wow.
Think about that.
Yeah.
We kept going. When I started, it was like 56 billion. Then it's 72 billion. And then it was like, whoa, they just kept going and going.
Now we're celebrating a few hundred million.
A billion feels good.
Yeah.
It's something, this might have been in the article that I didn't get to at hour two, but I'm just curious, how do salaries factor into all of this in terms of competitiveness? Are people moving to these other companies just because it's more exciting, they're more cutting edge, or is there a real salary increase from that of Boeing's?
Well, I mean, they get paid pretty well, but in this article, it does address that they can move to a place like Amazon and make more money, or other places and make some more money. But for a lot of these people, as is pointed out in this article, and I can back this up with the people that I know personally, it isn't aviation av geeks, as we call them. You know, they're a different breed. People who are interested in aerospace and flight, the money's never really been the object for the people who design these things. It's about the, you know, going out there, making it faster, making it bigger, making it more fuel efficient, watching it fly. I mean, if you've ever been out to one of those where they debut an airplane, it makes its first flight, and their engineers there are just, you know, it's like they're watching their children walk for the first time. And it's really cool. I was there, I got the fortune to see the 87 with its first flight at Payne Field. And, you know, you just feel this. It's a different kind of thing where money isn't necessarily the driver. It's the exploration and just the juice of aviation that I think has gotten a lot of these people involved in this. I mean, the money would be great, sure. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, for some people, that makes makes decisions. But for a lot of these people, they're just wired for aviation, and it's what they love.
It's also just the luck of the draw, or Boeing's bad luck streak, that Amazon is based in basically Boeing's backyard. So you don't have to uproot your family or anything.
Nope.
You could be a high flying engineer at Boeing and say, yeah, you know, I think I'll go to Amazon and not even have to move.
No,
you're already right there.
Yeah, you might have to pay the 520 toll, but, you know, I-90 is still
at those
free.
Those rates, they can afford it. Yeah, too. Very good. Okay, Chris, I think you're right. It's been too long. I hear you all the time on G and Ursula, so I feel like I talk to you practically every day anyway. But you're right. You haven't been on with me, and I'm happy you made it today.
Well, it's always great to talk to you guys.
Great. See you, Chris. All right, there he goes, Mr. Cherry Pie. Chris Sullivan knows everything there is to know about, I was going to say traffic, because he does know about traffic, but Boeing is also his beat. But now, turning to our traffic guru, Tracy Taylor, how are we looking out there? Anyway, that nice laugh you're hearing is from Sherry Elkert. I'm Tom Tangney. This is the Tom and Curly Show. John's away today. He has an eye doctor's appointment that was pre-scheduled, so this was not anything unexpected. We fully expect John to be back tomorrow, but stay tuned. Make sure you turn in. John will no doubt have multiple stories to tell if he misses 2 days in a row. So anyway, we're happy to have Sherry with us. And, you know, it's one of the things we have these pre-show meetings, and we also, as we put these shows together, come up with story suggestions that maybe Jacob hadn't run across. And, you know, you think you know somebody, and then Sherry suggests this story.
Bring your house and share your spouse. That is the motto of this soon-to-be trailer park and campground for swingers. Don't believe me? Take a look at the sign for yourself.
You can come to Mamu for many good things. This will be one of them.
David O'Gwen is opening T-Boy Swingers Trailer Park. For that's right, swingers. He says the swinger community is surprisingly bigger than you may think.
Bigger than most will know. Live free and don't be scared of it. There's a big community of it. I think a bunch of them is not shy. The ones that are shy, hell with them. Roll with it. Good thing compared to most things.
Since putting up this sign, Oakland's gotten calls from swingers across the country.
We have got some from Pennsylvania. We have got some from Arkansas. Of course, all around Acadiana, all around Mamou, Ville Platte, Lafayette, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Slidell. We have text messages from all over the country. It's mind-boggling.
He says they're getting so many calls, they can barely keep up with it.
Most of them call or text just to see if it's real. Just to see if somebody's going to answer, because they're going to say, oh, no, nobody's there. It's not a real number. Or they'll get on Facebook, oh, it's not a real number. I got on there and I said, I'd be a fat frog's butt if it's not a real number. Everybody starts calling. And they start calling, hey, what's y'all address? Where is it? Is this in my room? Where is this at? Yes, it is.
The sign for this swingers community says you have to send a picture of your spouse for approval, but Oakland says,
that was more of a joke to kind of ease up the people and just to create a vibe. People went further with it than you would imagine. We've gotten many pictures and many phone calls and many texts, voicemails. Unreal.
And Oakland says, as for the haters,
sucks to be them. There's no reason to be mad at anybody for their preference and not out here hurting nobody. Nobody's selling drugs here. People, no nothing. It's to have a good time, enjoy themselves the way they want to. That's perfectly what it is.
Now, it's none of my business what our viewers do in y'all's personal time, but if you are wondering when this Swingers Trailer Park is going to be open, the grand opening is set for Memorial Weekend of 2022.
All right, so Sherry, was it the incredible Louisiana accent? Was it the phraseology like fat frog's butt?
Right.
It sucks to be them, the y'all. What was it that you found compelling about this particular story?
It's a couple of things. One, it's two things I don't know anything about, and I'm very proud to admit that, swinging and the trailer park.
Okay.
But the other part is that this is such a big deal there. Listen to this other stuff that they've got planned, Tom. They've got a nude pool, nude yoga, a new yoga stadium, they said. I think they mean studio, but he said stadium. A strip poker hall and a key party cabana. And I had to look up what key party is. Did you know what a key party is?
Oh, yes. They were very popular. You know, in Suburbans, it's interesting. This is designed for a trailer park. But in the 70s, I think it was, there were novels and movies written about this. Key parties, I'm assuming now, unless there's something else, is when couples would come and they drop their car keys in a jar. And then you pull out a car key at random. And that would be who your new sex partner was for the night.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was kind of elaborate. And apparently they're asking people, they can either live there, they can bring their trailer and live there, or they can just visit and use it like kind of as a little home away from home vacation spot. But imagine living there. Wouldn't it get kind of, I don't know, creepy or awkward or whatever that, you know, you're sleeping with the guys across the street's wife and then you got to see him every day hauling out the trash. I mean, I don't know. It just, the whole thing.
You like
thing
to keep
was,
your fantasies at the fantasy level.
Yeah.
You don't want to see him taking out the trash in the morning.
No. I mean, that seemed kind of weird.
It just made me laugh, you know, when you ran across the story. And I do. John and I love local color, and this just spoke of that region, Mamua. I don't even know if that's a city, I guess, in Louisiana or something where this trailer park is going. But it did remind me, this is about 20, maybe even 25 years ago. It was early on in my career at Cairo, and I was covering, as a reporter, the Seattle International Film Festival. I was doing two stories a day, you know, and it's a 25-day festival. And one of the documentaries that I reviewed, I interviewed the director, and it was of Swingers. And he was a movie director who actually went to a Swingers community and made a movie about what exactly goes on in these key parties or these sex parties and the like. And I remember being struck by how did he get access to this? And so when I did this interview, I asked him, so was this a little odd here? You got an entire film crew inside a house, and it was, everything was happening inside a relatively modest house. It had multiple rooms, of course, but the people that gathered were in this house. He said, didn't it feel intrusive? And he says, well, no, because there was one condition upon which they allowed him access to film he filmed inside. And that was that not only he as the director, but every single crew member had to do it in the nude. So he says, it immediately kind of dropped our defenses. We were as much of them as they were of us. And so he said it worked at marvels. They relaxed. Of course the film crew was kind of like caught off guard, but then they all agreed to it. They signed whatever agreements they had to, and because of that, then everyone there sort of relaxed. The other thing that movie imprinted upon me was there, it's just like the nudist colonies. There are a lot of people that are into, nudist colonies that
right.
we never see in the media or our friends because it's something that people keep private, but it is an active community. And apparently there are swingers everywhere in the United States and I'm sure around the world. And this is just sort of shining a light on it. I hadn't heard specifically of a swingers club in a trailer park that does offer new and maybe inconvenient aspects to it, but still it's an interesting story, and I'll never think of you any differently than I always have. You're
okay,
very
well,
prim
good.
And proper, Miss Sherry Elliker.
Well, thank you, and you can see there's a growth opportunity, obviously.
Oh, yeah, that's right. In fact, suddenly I thought, oh, my God, I can't imagine Sherry and her Marine husband being, you know, in one of these things. And it turns out you haven't been. Not to say we don't welcome all swingers listeners and nudist members as well. So
no judgment here.
Yeah, no judgment. That's exactly right. And I think we stepped over the fat frog's butt clip again, but that's okay.
I'll be a fat frog's butt if it's not a real number.
You'll get some use out of that.
I think that's going to be a drop for the ages, too. Okay, and now we turn very innocently to Tracy Taylor and traffic. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Dangney here, Sherry Elliker filling in for John, who we expect to be back tomorrow. So this is a really interesting case, I think. Just to put it a little in perspective, they say Facebook has just under 3 billion followers. Christianity, 2.3 billion. Islam, 1.8 billion. What would happen if Facebook got together with the great religions in the world and decided to work in a kind of partnership? That is the new arena that a lot of religious organizations are facing, as Facebook is kind of culminating a two-year effort at endearing themselves to churches, to mosques, to synagogues, to assemblies of God. I mean, wherever there are people interested in religion and faith and talking about God, they are trying to make it easier for them, the religious, to communicate with their parishioners or their members in their church, and as a byproduct, perhaps improve the lot of Facebook users and Facebook investors. I thought this was a fascinating venture, and I hadn't even given it much thought. What's your take on this, Sherry?
My first thought was, what took them so long? I mean, this is, you know, this is something that I think is an obvious companionship, you know, or a companion thing, piece. Because, you know, with all the live streaming that goes on with Facebook and the idea that you could reach so many millions of people as they sit there in their beds or wherever they're going to sit and not necessarily have to go to church, I think it makes perfect sense. Now, I have to say, my grandfather was a minister. And so I spent many, many Sundays in church, and that was part of a weekly requirement of our family as we all went to church. And it was a different kind of feel, though. I mean, you relied on people in the church. You went to bake sales, and it was a real community. And we kind of dropped out of the whole thing when I became a teenager, and my grandfather died. And I often drive by churches and long for that, and think about that a lot, and think I'd like to be a part of that community again. But I don't have the time. You know, I don't want to invest in it. I don't want to do that. But I think to be able to find a source of faith or community in some capacity, because religion was very important to me at one point, I think it's great. I really don't have a problem with it. I mean, I get it's Facebook, right? So, I mean, you know, say what you want. But I think it's a good opportunity for people to be able to go to church, or at least have, you know, a little dose of it or something like that in the convenience of their own home.
Yeah, one of the reasons, as is so much of our 2021 life, it's been impacted by our 2020 life. And they say that, yes, that what the pandemic did was sort of force more churches to grapple with, you know, how to service their members, how to present religious services without having their churches open in a lot of cases. And so a lot of things went online that normally wouldn't have gone online. And that has just sort of accentuated this move toward that. And yes, to me, it makes perfect sense. Right now, I think it feels a little weird to us. We realize that Sheryl Strandberg, I think, has a great way to spin this, that, oh, Facebook and religion, we have a common, you know, goal, which is we're all about human communication, connection. Oh, give me a break. The bottom line for Facebook is to profit from that human connection, not to encourage human connection. That was the argument or the justification when Mark Zuckerberg was first starting out. Oh, yeah, this is going to be, you know, it's going to bring more people together. Well, we've seen that it doesn't exactly bring everybody together in a big kumbaya moment. So I think that's pushing it a bit much. But I also think any hesitation that any of us might feel about, having these tech platforms. And there are a lot of religious leaders that are a little leery about this because they say we have a lot of older members and they're not aware of how advertising can really impact them online. They're not super sophisticated in the ways of the internet. And so they might be misled by, various pitches for money or the like. But still, to me, it's a new medium. It's like television. Oh, my God. I don't know that your grandfather would be rolling over in his grave if he found out this is a way that he could contact more people and perhaps, raise more money for the church. It's just a new medium. It's like TV. The Catholic Church puts on, I watch, the Mass from Rome and St. Peter's every Christmas Eve because it's televised around the world. It's just easy access. It doesn't undercut religion's message. And I do think that Facebook, I don't believe that Facebook is any more religious than any other organization because they're helping out other religions. But I don't think that just because they may not have purely pure motives means that this isn't a medium worth of pursuing. So,
it's a business
good.
And so is religion to some degree. So we have to, figure all that into it. But I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Even as I was saying that, the bottom line for Facebook is money. There are a lot of cynical people thinking that a lot of preachers are really out for the bottom line money as well. But anyway, to each their own, or to each his own. Okay, it's time to turn to Tracy Itkin out on the roads.